Would you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah. Hey, I'm Tim Casher.
You know, what's changed since even you started is that the way people get a hold of music is so different. So in the old days, if a record was out for a month, you'd really be lucky if you went on stage and people were starting to sing along with the songs. Now, somehow, people know the songs before you've even recorded them.
That's actually a great point, because that's one I haven't maybe thought a ton about, because I have been touring through all of that transition. 10 years ago, our minds were fairly blown when people knew lyrics in a given song, and back then, probably rightfully so, because that's people who actually really had to seek it out, through the mail. I'll confess to maybe taking for granted a little bit that you can go out and play these shows, and it's great actually that people know the lyrics and are singing along already.
I read my liner notes and I'm thinking, okay, Whitefish, Montana, right? Steve's Garage in LA, various hotel rooms, Portland, Oregon, Chicago, and then finally mixed all the way, back there. So back in the hometown. So that this record is so completely organized in the way it turned out, and we'll get to the sequencing and all of that in a second. But this is a real record. So what was the reasoning behind recording this in so many places?
I can settle the mystery just by simply, we ran out of time up in Whitefish, and a cursive tour was coming up. So the odds and ends, all that additional recording is very much odds and ends, like very small things, like a female vocal or a shaker, or, stuff like that. But it's just stuff I didn't get a chance to get to before having to set off for a cursive tour. So thus scrambling and recording all of it on the finishing touches on a laptop.
One of the other projects was intended to be the solo outing, but it turned into more of a thing. So what does it feel like to finally say, okay, this technically is a solo record, even though there are other players on it, which we'll get to?
It is actually incredibly familiar. I keep comparing, at least in my own mind, I compare it so much to the first Good Life record. I mean, was what I had set out to do. Back then, I had considered going under my own name, but just didn't really have, just wasn't sure if that was the right move at the time. And now this time, now 10 years later, here I'm doing it again. And
this time you made it.
We did, I did. One of the reasons was I think the sillier conversation right now would be like, why continue using monikers, because I was going to go under yet another band name, and then we finally just came to the conclusion of like, come on, just, you've got your two bands already. It's, if you want to do something, set out and do something else, why don't you just, go under your own name?
Okay, so let me go for that. What this time were some of the band names that you did you go down the road of saying, okay, we could call it?
Yeah, for a while, for the longest name, actually probably the only name, was Edelweiss, which was the name that was going to be the Good Life, but didn't quite make the cut. But it's kind of stayed with me over the years.
Would you have to put Julie Andrews on the cover?
maybe the most compelling reason for not calling it Edelweiss was how often I would, yell that in a loud bar, and people would assume I said anal vice.
One of the things that I've read you say multiple times, but was really interesting to me, is that the good part about that is that there's the comfort factor. The bad part about that is you don't have anybody judging you, and you get what you get is what you get.
Yeah, although each album's still a learning process, and whatever, I can be dull and say, we'll always learn from these things. But there's truth to that. I mean, I guess you're always trying to figure out how to record and how to write or anything. But I feel more comfortable about myself as the critic. I'm maybe even on the other side of those concerns, where I wouldn't be as excited about having a producer maybe suggest that things go differently. Because I've gone over a hump where my own criticism was far too intense, and I've released some stuff that I thought was borderline fraudulent. Just in the sense that it was, I focused way too hard on becoming the singer that I'm not, and I wasn't just letting myself, do what we're supposed to do, which is just kind of sing from a place and kind of let it be what it is.
Well, I love records that are, I call them dark with a smile. So this record, the folks portrayed on this record are not exactly having an easy time with monogamy, are they?
No, I suppose not. I like that you say dark with a smile. Something that I've been working on in writing over the years is trying to find the humor and the I don't want to just say it's irony, because I think irony is too irony is like what we hide behind, you know, and I certainly don't like doing that, but being able to find like the humor and the sarcasm in these melodramas.
Oh yeah, and it's there, but as you read the lyrics, you really have to kind of, you know, go through. So again, I mentioned this earlier, but I'm really, I like records that are records. I still actually play records sometimes. And what's amazing to me is when I actually get one where I'm listening to the overture, and then, you know, you've sequenced this thing in a way that, in particular, for example, when it goes into, I'm afraid I'm going to die here. It's like you're getting a piece of the last song, and it's sequenced that way purposely, is it not?
Yeah. I have a blast doing that. I mean,
it's real, but this is pretty exceptional, because the other thing is, like, I was listening to it on the computer as I was writing the questions tonight, and you know, iTunes has a habit of, you know, trying to chop things, and if somebody dares to put this in a place where they, you know, use it digitally in the wrong way, they're going to miss out on a lot of the fun.
Yeah, and those conversations I've had those conversations over the years when sequencing, and you know, the onset of iTunes kind of changing the game for what I've always been doing, which has been kind of been making the record proper. I just throw it out the window. I just think, if you know, I mean, in the sense that I chop them up where they seem best to chop them up, and I'm already over my bitter attitude about people listening to these songs as, you know, as singles or as you know, like while they jog. I'm just happy if people are listening to music, you know, not even just music in general, but certainly I don't mind if they're responding to what I've been writing, but yeah, I wouldn't mind. I'd love it if people could actually sit down on an evening and
listen. I'm Afraid I'm Gonna Die Here, which was the first track I played. It immediately resonated with me in many ways. But it's the happiest horn intro of a song that talks about being stuck as a slice of American pie.
Yeah.
There's lots of multiple levels there, isn't there?
Well, yeah, just playing with that that stark contrast is definitely not something. It's something I've been doing, I guess, for a while. And I love pop music so much, and I'm always trying to write pop music.
This record really embodies not the word pop as we talk about it today, but the word pop as in popular, as in Pete Townsend called power pop. You know, he said the Who was power pop because they were powerful and popular.
It's really during this period of interviewing where I learn a lot about what these albums are about. And something I noticed on this one, or that kind of came to light for me, was I do try to have some kind of resonance, some kind of positive resonance at the end of most of my records, even though it doesn't seem that way. I take that back. I think it does seem that way. I think it used to. I think I'm becoming even older and more callous. I mean, I don't realize it though until after the record's done. I certainly don't set out to write something like to damage. And I do still try to recognize some kind of a positive. Well, it's not really necessarily positivity, but more maybe it's like an acceptance of a, you know, at the end, it's like, maybe it's not ideal, but these people's lives are can are continuing to go on.
But this record, there was a guy in the 70s named, he's still around. I mean, he's now known for the Pina Colada song, but way before this, Rupert Holmes did these amazing narratives that this record reminds me of. So have you actually thought that this could be a narrative and turn into a script of some sort?
I always love that idea, and I think, and I always have that. I think I have that daydream at the beginning of most every record I do, and I kind of I haven't gotten to that point of being able to write. I can write full stories separately, and I can write these albums separately, but I haven't been able to quite bring together that, like, the rock opera. Always seems too daunting. Although I'd like to hit it at some point in my life.
Yeah, the second you say a rock opera, suddenly it becomes a, it's a two-record set. Because don't rock operas technically have to be at least two records, theoretically? So I had the pleasure of talking to your friend Connor Oberst, literally when his first two, the two records aligned at exactly the same time. And he was really, I think, an unlikely star. And then suddenly, of course, everything just went boom and it hit, in a big way. So you both grew up in Nebraska and you both do make music that really does affect people. People do pay attention to it. They do pay attention to the lyrics. There's always something to say there. In terms of the two of you growing up together, were there things that were kind of in the mix there that you think kind of, was there something in the water or something in the snow or something in the cold of winter? Or
I don't know if I've thought of it this way in the past, but the way that you just kind of asked that question, what comes to mind for me is I think that all of our the community that we came out of, like, there's a really tight knit group of friends that were of musicians that really helped, that supported all of us to be we weren't self-conscious at all. And I think especially as a teenager and as young adults, that's such a huge that's so damaging for writing. I think we were on the contrary, we were lauded for it even early on. People liked that kind of liked for any of us to kind of write more candid. That's super uncool, but amongst all of our friends back then, that was we kind of made it acceptable for each other.
So one of the other things that I read is you said that you were the last of six kids and therefore you don't have to really be an adult. So does this become the midlife crisis album?
I had a pretty good conversation with someone the other day that gave me a further excuse for why I seem to have this arrested development. Both in reality and also this complex, is that this bit of being a musician and touring all the time, I've been doing it since I was 20. And these are all, you think that your formative years are beyond you, but actually all the formative years of becoming an adult, I spent in a van and, having, nightly people buying shots for me and just playing. I've been on a playground for like the last 16 years, essentially. Yeah. I've always joked that especially when I see, people from my high school and they're like, they're all proper, well, most of them are proper adults. And I kind of will just kind of, playfully chide that I'm just about a year old. I'm only about a year older from the last time they saw me. But I think there's a lot of truth to that, actually.
We do a thing called a musical sandwich, and it's two of your songs as the bread and then songs by anybody else you want to play in between.